You are all weirdos.
Weird science is the revolution. Weird science is the revolution.
Welcome, all you weirdos, 90s animation fans, and obscure aspects of the Shadow King. It is time for your 91st Weird Dose of X, the mutant member of your Weird Science family. I am your Goblin Force Herald Jason, broadcasting as always from the Wrong Turn Studio, high atop stately Weird Science Tower. And here with me is a man who is wearing a business suit while piloting a giant business suit wearing mech. It's my pal Ruben. Hey Ruben, how the heck are you today?
Good.
Are you two layers or three layers deep in business suits? I always lose track.
Yeah, I don't do the three-piece suit. I think they look cool, but I've just never had a reason to own one.
Well, dare to dream, maybe you can make one out of Mysterium. It'll definitely be the envy of all your businessman friends. So today, this is not actually a male fashion podcast, although maybe it will be going forward after we have some time off. But today we're going to talk about three comic books, X-Men Forever number 1, Invincible Iron Man number 16, and Resurrection of Magneto number 3. But first, folks, you may have heard of a little thing called X-Men 97, which I'm told is like a moving pictures version of our favorite mutants. And it's now airing, or streaming anyway, on the Disney Plus service. Now, personally, I am far too old and mature to watch cartoons that don't come from Japan. But lucky for us, Ruben isn't. So Ruben, what do you make of X-Men 97?
Yeah, if you had any interest in the original X-Men, the animated series TV show, you will be happy watching this one. I don't think I watched every episode, and I was sort of shocked when I went back and looked and saw there were 70-some-odd episodes of the original run. But it was a part of my comics fandom in the 90s. I think pretty much everyone watched it. And
are the original run is also on Disney Plus?
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. Neat.
So you can watch all of it. And yeah, I think it was on Fox originally. That's my recollection. It was probably everything, right? But that's where I saw it. Yeah, but I was kind of wary about going back to the 90s era and this idea of like, let's resurrect the animation style and, you know, follow from that storyline. But I checked it out. My wife got some tips from a friend of hers when she was a high schooler. I think she was an X-Men fan. And okay, pretty much grew up, whereas I'm still reading comics. But, you know, of that era, she enjoyed it. And so she kind of heard from her high school buddy who also watched it that it was good. So I was like, you know what? Why not? I'll check it out.
Yeah, it does seem to be breaking through to the, like, you know, we know all the comics people kind of talk about comics people thing. But it seems to have broken through to like a bigger group of more normal people who, you know, maybe keep up with the MCU movies, but aren't actually into the comics like we are.
Yeah, no, exactly. So she was like, let's watch it. So we watched it. And the first two episodes, I think the third episode comes out on Wednesday, but some people are reviewing it. I don't know how that works. But in any event, I was pleasantly surprised. It did feel like the comic, but they've added some more modern conventions. Like they mentioned Storm as an Omega mutant, which my wife's like, what's an Omega? And of course, you know, I loved explaining that. And I forget what other references there were, but there were a handful of references where it was just kind of like, you know, loose references to more modern continuity. But
okay, so some modern references, but it's the main storylines are mostly the Chris Claremont stuff still, right?
Yes, exactly. It's that era, and the animation, the art style looks similar, but it's been certainly updated, so it's more smooth. The action is just really cool. The pacing is great, and yeah, it hit on all notes. So I wasn't really surprised. I think it is like 100% on Rotten Tomatoes at this point, which is nuts. And it's worth it. I would even encourage you to check it out just to kind of get a sense of that era.
Yeah, I'll throw on an episode. Should I just start with episode one? Or I guess there's only two out so far, so it's not like...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, honestly, you could just watch episode one and be like, okay, this is cool, and then just stop. It's sort of self-contained. Some people are criticizing it, saying like it's too like singular each episode, but
I mean, that's how TV used to be, right? I mean, I'm old enough to remember when, like, it was like that because it was on TV, and if you missed it when it was broadcast, you missed it. So that's the way stories were structured, so that if you missed an episode, you didn't stop watching, like I did with the second season of Twin Peaks. I loved the first season of Twin Peaks, and then the second season, it was, I think my memory was moved around different time slots, and once I lost the plot, I kind of just stopped watching, but... Yeah. Nowadays, with everything being on streaming, it that doesn't happen anymore. But yeah, it does seem like even in that sense, they're calling back to that old way that TV shows were made.
Yeah, it's really fun. I'm a big fan of it. I'm not sure. Well, there are some things in it that are kind of like old school. And I was like, well, maybe this is what we'll go back to in the comic side, right? And I kind of missed it. So, you know, they're hanging out at the mansion and they're playing basketball, right? There's some like social stuff going on where they're just kind of hanging out. And I'm like, oh, yeah, they used to do that a lot in the 90s, right? Because they were at the school and they were doing rec stuff in addition to the Danger Room stuff. So there were just elements of it where I was like, oh, it's kind of nostalgic. I wouldn't mind seeing that back in the comics again. But there was some there, you know, there's a very strong, like, you know, anti-mutant humans kind of element that's just kind of like, oh, God, I don't want that just to be all we have, you know, in the next 5-year
right,
arc.
But right.
We'll see.
Okay. So, listeners, if you're kind of sick of all this Krakoa stuff, which is wrapping up soon, but if you want a hit of that pure 90s Claremont kind of version of the X-Men, you got another place to go for that. Let us know what you think of it. Okay.
Yeah, so. And I'm avoiding spoilers, but I would love to talk about them. There's some interesting stuff that they're going to do in this run, basically pulling back to some even earlier but more important kind of continuity storylines that I haven't seen in film or cartoon.
Sounds cool. So that's the cartoon update, and now on to the books of pictures that don't move. The first book we're going to talk about, once I hit my ding sound, there we go, is X-Men Forever number 1. A Ghost, a.k.a. Immortal X-Men Legacy number 19, a.k.a. Rise of the Powers of X Legacy number 0. I made those last two up, but basically it's true. It's written by Kieran Gillen, art by Luca Maresca, colors by Federico Blee, letters by Clayton Cowles, designed by Tom Muller, Jay Bowen, and Kat Gregorowitz. That's a new name on our design line there. I'm wondering what that's about. Are there new design elements? The only thing I can come up with is that the logo on the cover is like a fractured, distressed version of the Immortal X-Men logo. Mm-hmm. Maybe Kat Gregorowitz did that bit. Again, one of those things that only I notice because I write down the credits of every issue in my little document here, but I'm curious about such things. So, that detail aside, I'm not going to hide my cards here. This is a really good book. I mean,
yeah.
No surprise, it's Kieran Gillen. We're kind of shills for Kieran Gillen here. We love everything he does, and We enjoy his way of telling things. This book fills in a lot of gaps, answers some questions, confirms some of our speculations, and generally just makes this whole side of the story sturdier. It all fits together now. We can tell he's done the work on the foundation.
Yeah, this was the kind of issue that, you know, a lot of people I saw complaining about it were saying like, oh, it's just kind of going in the past and plugging in a lot of stuff. But I actually really liked that element of it because there were parts that just went by really fast and we're like, oh, that's weird. Like, what the hell is going on there? Right. We just kind of trusted that Gillen would give us those details. Right. And here's the issue that does it. So for me, I was like, man, this is good. I'm fine, like, with mysteries and issues. If you can trust a writer to like explain them. Right. Actually.
Yes.
It's almost bigger when that happens. And this fills in so many of the questions. I'm sure you'll even say some stuff where I was like, oh, yeah, I didn't even remember that being a question.
Most of them make sense. There's a couple places a little hand-wavy, but we'll get to those eventually. So listeners, if you haven't read this issue already, before you do so or after, I'd recommend rereading Immortal X-Men number 1 and Immortal X-Men number 18, and also maybe Rise of the Powers of X number 1. And if you still have some free time on your hands, go back and read the Before the Fall Sinister 4 one-shot. Because they're all kind of connected here. Okay, everybody back from that reading assignment? Here we go. To put this book into context, I'm going to give you a short excerpt from the March 20th edition of Gillen's newsletter. So he says, it's a weird one, this. I'm not going to do his accent. It's very British. It's a weird one, this. At its heart, this is Immortal X-Men number 19, and is basically material I was planning to be released in January alongside Rotpox 1. When Marvel's publication plans meant they wanted it in March, it needs to serve a different purpose. We join Rotpox in motion, and then leave nagging questions to explain 2 months into the event. The material was remixed for this purpose a little. A little distance between Xavier and the reader is useful, and I tried to write into that. What's he up to? How did he get here? And here we say why, or at least some of it. Despite all the above, I'm quite fond of the issue. Okay, end of quote. So yeah, that's interesting stuff, don't you think? It's confirmation that Marvel's publication plans for Fall of X did certainly change, and kind of at the last minute, it seems, if if things he was planning on happening in January had to push back 2 months. Again, I would love to have any of these guys like sit down in the bar next to me and really get the straight scoop on what happened, but we're not going to get that. We've seen plenty of evidence for this change on the Duggan side of the event, although I have to say that Gillen has handled the changes way more elegantly, making it feel more like it's on purpose, even though it's in response to something out of his hands. Okay, enough of that real-world stuff. On to the issue itself. The issue is written in two sections. The first and shorter section, before the credits page, revisits the opening scene from Immortal X-Men number 1. This part has narration boxes from Destiny's point of view. The second and longer part explains more about what happened at the end of Immortal X-Men number 18 and connects that series directly with the Rise of Powers of X number 1. This section has no narration boxes. We open the book in 1899 at the very first performance of Edward Elgar's Enigma Variations. This orchestral suite did indeed premiere at London's St. James Hall on June 19, 1899. In the Marvel version of the story, those in attendance include Destiny, Mystique, and off on the side somewhere, Mr. Sinister. When the 9th of the 14 variations starts playing, the one that Elgar titled Nimrod, Destiny first thinks she hears whistling, and then has a full-on prophetic vision of a whole lot of stuff. I think the implication is that she sees the general shape of the entire Krakoan era, and also she sees Enigma, the Essex Dominion. It's in the center of all these visions and is whistling a tune. So what did you think of this vision here?
I thought it was cool. I kind of just thought about Destiny in general and how she deals with these things, right? Like, she gets these very detailed visions, but like, I don't even know how she would make any sense of like what's going on here.
That's true. It's got to be really disorienting with no context to see something that happens, I mean, from her point of view, what, like 100+ years in the future?
Yeah. Even just seeing Colossus, right? You're like, why is there a metal dude?
A giant sentinel robot. This guy with a visor on his eyes being arrested. I guess this happens to her all the time, though, so maybe she's kind of used to it.
And
it's the Dominion in the center of it that's probably the most out of the ordinary. But yeah, it's kind of fun to think about how she knew all this stuff way before she did any of the things that she's done in the comics since, right? Joining the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, working with Magneto, all that stuff. That whole time, she knew about Krakoa, which maybe, I mean, obviously it's a big old retcon, but it's fun to think about. Another little thing, when I looked up some background on Elgar's Enigma Variations, I saw that the Wikipedia write-up says there's the enigma of the title is, quote, widely believed to be a hidden melody. And poking a little more other places, the idea is that what Elgar wrote as his melody was really a counter-melody, like a melody that goes along with another melody, but that original melody that he was doing a counter melody to doesn't actually appear in the work itself. So my headcanon is that what Enigma is whistling here is the hidden melody that no one's been able to find in 100 years. Little classical music trivia there for you.
Yeah, that's a little cool element too.
It does seem like the kind of thing that that Gillen would put in there and then not mention. We know he's not a classical music guy, as far as I know, but he's very much a music guy.
Yeah. I'm curious if someone's like a musician, they can look at the notes, because you see notes behind the Enigma set. You can probably confirm it.
Too much of it goes behind. We only get like a measure and a half at a time. Too much kind of it goes behind the head of Enigma. I wasn't able to really figure out what it might be, but I gave it a shot. Okay, after that scene, we now jump to a retelling of the first scene of Immortal Number 1. It's 1919, 20 years after that performance, and Mr. Sinister is sitting on a Paris park bench, whistling, presumably, the Enigma tune. Destiny approaches him and they have a conversation we've seen before, the one where Destiny tells him, we must be on the same side. This time we get to hear more of it, which is going to be a running theme of this issue. She tells Sinister that the true Nathaniel Essex is dead. She tells him about the 4 clones running around the world, and then, hey, buddy, you, Mr. Sinister, you're just one of those 4 clones, the one that's all into mutants and stuff. She tells him that the clones are just a means for the dead Nathaniel Essex to, quote, achieve something grander than godhood. Now, just like in Immortal Number 1, at this point, Sinister starts bleeding from his face, keels over, and repeats, you're a ghost, you're a ghost. But here, the scene doesn't end. Here, Enigma himself shows up to have a chat with Destiny. So she knew she had actually interacted with Enigma all the way back 100+ years ago. And I really love the way Maresca depicts this. Enigma fills up the entire sky, more than twice the size of the Eiffel Tower, which really is a cool perspective. But he also, at the same time, appears to be right there in front of Destiny. Really gets at the whole outside of space and time thing for me. Now, Destiny is not all that intimidated. She realizes that if Enigma wanted her dead, she'd just be dead. He wouldn't show up here to try to intimidate her. So Enigma is protecting this timeline. It seemed like he's not quite sure if he has to, but he's playing it safe. He wants Destiny to live because he needs Krakoa to happen because, as we saw, all those sinister paths that got him his energy to be a Dominion kind of come out of Krakoa. As always, the exact cause and effect nature of how a Dominion might be retroactively prevented from happening is too much for my little human brain to comprehend, but it's a fun conversation to observe.
I like that part because it sort of shows this idea of the Dominion. It is outside of time and space, but it still has kind of limits on its knowledge, which I think is a really cool element of this, mm-hmm. is that it's really hard to fight, but it's not God, right? As much as it wants to be. And
mostly what it seems to not know is it doesn't know the limits of being a Dominion.
And so I thought it was a really cool element. I also appreciated that we got a little bit more of that conversation because that was one of those things for me where I was like, what the heck was that conversation?
Well, yeah, I think you predicted some of this, didn't you? That Enigma is the one who steps in to make Sinister keel over and stop listening to all the stuff he doesn't want him to know yet.
So, my take on this, though, is he actually killed him. I was unsure about that. I actually think he killed off this Sinister, and we're, you know, the one that we eventually see in Krakoa is not this one. I would assume it's another like clone of the Diamond Sinister because he hangs out with a bunch of them in Bar Sinister, right?
Yeah, I have a question about that, too. I mean, there's a couple ways it could go. It could be that Enigma kills him off and then brings him back with no memory of this conversation, right? Mind wipe thing, like we're going to talk about later with Shaw. He's in a Dominion. He could do that. Or maybe this Sinister already has his clone system all figured out. And as soon as he dies here, another Sinister clone pops out.
Because regardless, this one would die, right? Because this would be the one. Let's say he's not dead, right? So he wakes up, he's got this knowledge, but then he would get killed off by the clone of his after Xavier talks to him, right? Because
I'm pretty sure he's dead.
Yeah.
Or again, maybe dead and then revived without the memory.
And then killed again, right, by his own clone, who's the one that becomes Sassy Sinister, avoid
at the beginning of
Charles.
House of X.
Yep.
And
so regardless, he's dead.
Did
Mr.
Sinister die in between there? I don't know the Sinister's history all that well. All these characters seem to have died a couple times.
Probably.
Not Storm, though. Storm.
Not Storm. Regardless, yeah, I just thought it was cool. And I like this idea of the Enigma engine basically deciding, like, I can't kill anything, really, until after the point in time when I come into power.
Like, let's be careful here. I'm probably going to be okay even if I did kill her because outside time and space, but why not err on the side of caution? What could it hurt to leave a few of these puny mutants alive? And of course, we're probably going to find out exactly what it hurts. So at the end of the conversation, Enigma gets a little bit petty. He says to Destiny, "Do you want to know why Mystique leaves you?" That's pretty cold, isn't it? For this giant cosmic beast to just try to get under her skin like that.
Yeah, well, it's Nathaniel Essex, right? He is petty.
It is. He's a Dominion, but he's still that little jerk. That's fun. And I think that's going to be important, too. Enigma disappears, and then we see the rest of the stuff that we already saw in Immortal Number 1, the bit where Destiny says to Mystique, just don't ask me. You trust me, right? Yeah, you trust me. Okay. Don't ask me about this stuff ever again. If you have to know about it, I'll let you know. Which, again, very convenient for that 100 years of her never bringing this up again. So that's the first section. Then we get the credits. The second section starts right after the credits, and it's set at the end of Immortal Number 18. So these really are like bookends to the whole Immortal X-Men series at the beginning and here at the end. Here, Mother Righteous, she's having a bad day. Her whole plan of killing Jean Grey in the White Hot Room to achieve her own Dominionhood was thwarted by Enigma, by the dead Nathaniel Essex. She's just found out about this. The animated doll version of her is still there in the White Hot Room, and when it gets kicked in the face by Destiny, the real Mother Righteous feels it too. That's a funny little scene. She goes from thinking she's about to be an immortal god to being kicked in the face across dimensions. Good stuff. We saw that kick happen in Immortal 18, but we didn't then get to see the ramifications back here in the real world. So once again, we get to see a little bit more of stuff we already kind of knew about. Doll Mother Righteous makes a deal with Hope and company, because Hope's about to kill her. Mother Righteous says that as much as they were enemies up until just a moment ago, hey, now we're on the same side. I want to stop Enigma just as much as you do, maybe even more. So Doll Mother Righteous offers to help them communicate with the real world, and also, very little sneaky part here, I can help you, quote, find out about Mystique, which, of course, Destiny latches onto right away, because they haven't seen Mystique since she appeared to die at the gala. So that's one side of the Mother Righteous radio set taken care of. What about the other? Well, back in the real world, Orbis, Stellaris, and Dr. Stasis, who at this time is not dead yet, they appear in Mother Righteous's lair. Now, this team-up of the Spade and Club Sinisters against Mother Righteous was teased on the very last page of Gillen's Before the Fall Sinister Four one-shot, which is a book I haven't thought of in months, but that's where we saw them, right? Because they were, in that book, Dr. Stasis was pretending to be surprised at, oh, there's more Sinisters around? There's more Nathaniel Essexes? And on the last page, we find out that he was faking because he was already teamed up with Orbis. Now, the team-up on her here is unsuccessful as Mother Righteous escapes by using up a backwards thank you on Stasis, who becomes her, you know, her simp right there. Kind of like we saw in that one shot. Mother Righteous's day goes from bad to worse because now here's Selene. And backwards thank you magic does not work on someone as old and powerful as Selene because she knows the loopholes. What loopholes? Yeah, that's a little hand-wavy, but that's fine. Selene's been around forever, super powerful.
And she's a magic
I'm mostly
person.
Fine with her just waving this off. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm fine with it. It's magic. Selene's magic. You know, we've long known that she's also not really a gracious person, so I'm not sure at what point she would have actually given Mother Righteous her thanks, other than like the generic like one that was given on her behalf, you know, when they were like, on behalf of Krakoa, thank you, Mother Righteous. But I could see Selene not particularly being bound by that one.
So, Mother Righteous, she gets badly injured by Selene, like some sort of generic energy blast, shards of glass looking thing. Mother Righteous does escape, but she has to use up one of the trapped gods of those glowing spheres of hers to get out of the building. Her bad day is still not over. She's got like a third round of this video game to escape, and this one is Charles Xavier. He's the boss here. He traps her by surrounding her with anti-magic knives made of cold iron and mysterium. And now she's toast. No escaping this. Charles tells her, welcome to the X-Men. And that's how Mother Righteous gets shanghaied onto Professor X's No Place team. Another little, how that happened? Now we know the story. All right. We now jump into that No Place, still under construction. So we're before Rotpox number one. Charles tells Mother Righteous that he was the one who leaked her location to Orcus, and kind of set up that whole, you know, the Sinisters and Selene going after her, kind of to make her run so that he could catch her. And then we get a teleconference appearance by Sebastian Shaw. It has been a long time since we've seen him on panel. He was also in on the Stick It to Mother Righteous plan, because he's had it in for her ever since his deal to own Krakoa after the gala didn't quite work out to his satisfaction. And here's an odd detail that it feels kind of tacked on that Gillen had to do this to fix something up to make it work later on. He has Shaw tell Xavier to mind wipe him of all the memories of this little anti-Mother Righteous plan so that Orcus can't ever dig into his brain and find out about it.
Yeah. I actually thought this was a nice little convenient way for them to explain away why he didn't necessarily go after the Hellfire Club with the codes. Because this would be after the codes, right? Because that was like a conversation when this Charles was like first on Krakoa, right?
That's true. That would have happened in between whatever immoral issue that was. I think it was 12 and this one here.
Yeah. I still would have liked to have seen the Kingpin Shaw feud over ownership of the Hellfire Club, but at least it would explain to me why we didn't see that.
Yeah, I still think it would have happened in the gap, and I wish we'd gotten to see it too. Maybe someday that'll be in some book, but I think we're just sweeping that under the rug. Okay, now, with Mother Righteous still trapped there, the No Place, we see the birth of Sinister Doug. Xavier tells us, and again, it's kind of like explaining, don't ask questions about this. Oh, he tells us, all the remaining Sinister genetic dregs are now purged from me. He says it in a way that we're not supposed to question. Real Doug is still trapped inside Krakoa, as is the real physical body of Sinister. And I had a question about this too, like which version of Sinister is this in Doug? And we're told now that Sinister Doug transfers into himself the full consciousness of the inside Krakoa Sinister, and then he kills off that Sinister body. Just cleans things up nice and neat, a little hand-wavy, but we're supposed to accept it. Xavier is free of Sinister, and the guy who looks like Doug is now 100% the real Mr. Sinister. Next, Mother Righteous tells Xavier about how all those thousands of missing mutants, the ones he thinks are just plain dead that he's responsible for making dead, they're actually safe and sound in the White Hot Room. As safe and sound as you can be in the White Hot Room. This stuns Xavier, naturally, because this is what he's been beating himself up over for, you know, issues and issues now. My question here is, if Xavier didn't know about those mutants, then he didn't know that Mother Righteous would be a way to communicate with those mutants. So why exactly did he need to capture Mother Righteous? What was his plan here? Do we know?
Yeah, good question.
Are her powers needed for the functioning of the No Place plan beyond the communication part? Maybe they told us about that in Rise of the Powers of X, but if so, I've forgotten about it. Okay, I think that's a little bit of a loose end, but that might be my memory being faulty. Okay, we're almost done. Long issue. Communication between the No Place and the White Hot Room is achieved. Jump forward in time a little bit. And Destiny, naturally, immediately asks about Mystique. Xavier puts on his I'm being a psychic face, and he finds Mystique on Krakoa. Guess he never bothered to look for her before being asked. He's a busy guy, that's fine. But her being on Krakoa is kind of surprising. The last time we saw Mystique was at the end of Uncanny Spider-Man. Remember that crazy series? She parted ways with Nightcrawler by saying, quote, I'm going to find my wife. So it's not crazy that she might find a way to Krakoa. Although, kind of like the Shaw Kingpin story, we're skipping over how she got there. Are the Sentinels still guarding the island? How did she get through? All that kind of stuff. I don't think we're supposed to ask those questions. She's on Krakoa. And when Professor X sends her a psychic phone call from Destiny, she doesn't pick up the phone. She's found, quote, the book, which I guess is that latest book of prophecy that Destiny wrote after being resurrected on Krakoa. Is that the right book I have in mind?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Are we supposed to know exactly what it is in there that would cause this rift between Mystique and Destiny, or is that still kind of secret?
My belief is that it's, I think it's a little bit secret, but my speculation is it's got to have something about talking about she knew about Enigma, knew that Krakoa would fail, and blah, 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 right?
Probably, unless it turns out to be something more personal. Although, we know this is all going to get patched up because there's a wedding issue coming down the pike. So, not too much drama there. Okay, we jump to weeks later, and now it really is the last scene. The No Place is fully armed and operational. Mother Righteous is inside a protective egg, and all crew members are on board. Maresca draws the interior of the No Place a little differently than R.B. Silva does in Rise. And I notice here that we see tons of these small yellow egg shapes all over the No Place floor. Is that new? I don't think I remember seeing that before.
Yeah, I don't recall what those are. Or what those
Any
would be.
Idea what that might be about? They have the fingerprint motif that we've seen in who was the artist for Immortal X-Men? Wernick. Lucas Wernick uses that fingerprint thing a lot.
Yeah, not sure.
So it looks cool. I don't know if these are just decorative or if these eggs are supposed to signal something. Maybe it'll pay off down the road. Maybe it just looks kind of cool. Xavier says that, quote, the X-Men are beginning their assault on Orcus, which timestamps us right at the beginning of Fall of the House of X. Xavier sends Rachel off on the mission that'll become dead X-Men. And we learn that Rachel thinks that the reason she's on this team is because, again, she thinks, she's been told, Xavier plans on resurrecting the Phoenix. And if you're going to resurrect the Phoenix, who else are you going to have around?
Yeah, former Phoenix host.
For sure. Now, Sinister Doug points out, you know, after Rachel leaves, that when Rachel learns that Xavier isn't, quote, telling her the whole truth, whoever heard of Xavier not telling the whole truth, Rachel's going to be pretty upset. And the book ends with Xavier saying that, well, if we survive that long, I'll live with that. Now, I do really enjoy this untrustworthy ends justify the means version of Professor X, because I think it really fits with the Professor X who set up Krakoa and lied and hid about all these secrets about Moira. And this really is the same Professor X that we've had since Hox Pox. And I like to see that continuity.
I wonder if he's like gotten comfortable with the idea of like, oh, I didn't kill off the mutants, so my choices weren't bad.
It would be interesting to have a little scene of him reflecting and, you know, thinking about all these changes and all these revelations and, you know, reflecting on the whole Krakoan era and what his choices were, which we could get. I mean, we have some issues that could happen. But something here does confuse me. The Phoenix. I mean, the Phoenix always confuses me, but even beyond that. What is the current status of the Phoenix? Because Rachel thinks that the Phoenix is dead. But isn't Maya Lopez, aka Echo, currently the Phoenix? Or is that Avengers continuity and we're separating that from X-Men continuity, which shouldn't be the case, but no one in this whole Krakoan era, a whole this Kieran Gillen Phoenix stuff, no one mentions Echo. Shouldn't that connect somehow?
I don't think Echo is Phoenix anymore. I don't know why that's the case, but I think I read somewhere that she's not. And I think maybe she just has a connection. It seems like anyone who is formerly a host has weird connections to the White Hot Room.
Last I knew that she was just, in Avengers at least, they were calling her the Phoenix. They were saying she is the Phoenix, and maybe that's changed somewhere. I'll have to look that up in between recordings, but I'd like that to be clearer. Okay, that little thing aside, this was a really good issue. I had a ton of fun reading it. I liked confirming some of the things we predicted. I liked learning the connections, setting up the new mysteries.
Yeah, I just looked it up just to answer your question. At the end of Avengers Assemble Omega, she loses the power of the Phoenix.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't get quite to the end of Jason Aaron's Avengers. It kind of lost me with all the multiple worlds thing. But okay, it's still, you'd think that the X-Men would mention that somebody else was the Phoenix for, you know, some pretty significant events. But it's X-Men stuff. They don't want to mention that. But yeah, good issue. I'm going to miss Kieran Gillen when he's not writing X-Men comics anymore a whole lot. Maybe the next era is going to be fun too, but so far none of the names that have been announced make me think, oh, well, they're going to do cool stuff as cool as Kieran Gillen's been doing.
Yeah, he definitely picked up the Hickman torch, like the spirit of the Fox era.
The big ideas followed
this and kind of went through Immortal and then ended. I was actually thinking about that this weekend. I was like, I wonder if I could sit down and like write out, you know, the stories that are just like the core stories where the good stuff happened. And the only thing I think that you'd get stuck with adding in that you wouldn't want to add in is how Moira kind of became a cyborg. Because I think that happened in the, it was like
Inferno.
Some weird.
It was Inferno. Lives of Wolverine, and or was it Inferno? Lives and Deaths. Those both kind of connected to each other. And I forget exactly what happened where, but.
Yeah, I think it was the X Lives and Deaths of Wolverine that you'd have to read because that was when she, I think, got depowered, maybe? No. In any event, I feel like you'd have to read that. Yeah,
she had cancer and she got depowered and sent out on the lam. And then she took that one scientist kind of hostage and made him put her brain in the robot. Yeah, all that kind of stuff happened.
But I still feel like you could probably put together a pretty cool, like, essential reading list that skips a lot of the stuff that just falls apart, including Fall of the House of X. I feel like
turned out to be inessential. Yeah.
Yeah. Even the stuff in Fall of the House of X that is like the key details, it feels like it gets just kind of mentioned in summary in, you know, Rise of the Powers of X.
Or possibly Powers of 10. Who the hell knows anymore? Well, yeah, that was that issue. I had a really good time. The only kind of criticism I have is it is kind of a grab bag, right? We're patching up the holes here. We're filling in the blanks. It doesn't have like an arc of a story of its own. It's still good, but I do wonder how this would have read as Gillen initially intended it, right? What would Immortal X-Men number 19 have looked like? And he does a really good job of setting up mysteries in Rotpox and then answering them here, kind of telling the story inside out and backwards. But I am curious what it would have been like if he hadn't had to do that.
Yeah, I kind of rolled my eyes with the whole idea of this even just being a number one issue. Can you imagine somebody picking this up? Oh, X-Men Forever. That sounds interesting. Let me check out what's going on in X-Men.
There have been X-Men Forever books in the past, and you know those were just, as far as I know, kind of regular number one issues when they started. But yeah. I figure it must be a marketing thing where Marvel thinks that, Immortal X-Men number 19 would get this many purchases, but call it X-Men Forever number one, it'll get, you know, 2x purchases, something like that. But yeah, this is clearly the best X book we've read since the last Kieran Gillen X book we read. And as such, I'm going to give this, I'm going to go all the way up to 8.8 out of 10. Really
nice.
Good book.
Yeah. I was at a 9. I think your question about like what was Xavier's point in grabbing Mother Righteous is a good point, and I don't have a good answer for that, so I gotta pull back to like an 8.5 at this point. But I think I went into the Slack and I was like, okay, this is a good apology note. As much as I hated the last episode of, or last issue of Fall of the House of X, and just felt insulted, this felt like there's a story, things happen for reasons, let's show you what those reasons were.
Characters are acting like themselves for yeah, good in-story reasons. They kind of connect to each other. Yeah,
the threat seems like an actual threat and not just a joke. And these, yeah, just like all the stuff that I've cared about is in here. And yeah, even Charles with his beard. I'm kind of, and even just kind of like meta question, like we were kind of told that Xavier's kind of out of the picture after this for a bit when we get Magneto running things.
Yeah, so he's like, gonna be actually Prisoner X, he's gonna be shunted away for a while, locked up.
Yeah, so I just kind of like, what's Prisoner X, right? Like, seems like he's free of Essex.
Right, because that was a speculation I had seen, is, oh, he's still kind of suspect about having the Mr. Sinister in his head, and that's why we got to lock him away. But at least here, it seems pretty definitive that Sinister is out of him.
Yeah. I was kind of actually wondering, is maybe what happens is he's free of Sinister for a hot minute, and then he just, like, absorbs Enigma into his brain. And maybe that's why he's got to lock himself up.
Well, he's going to do something that makes the world, you know, angry at him and makes him like the scapegoat where he gets locked up and all the other mutants get to, you know, be on their merry way in Alaska and Louisiana and all over the world. Okay, that was, what was this again? Not Immortal X-Men. I want to say Immortal X-Men. This was X-Men Forever, number one. And now we're moving on to another book, not quite as complicated. Probably won't need to talk about it quite as long. This is Invincible Iron Man, number 16, Splash Damage. Or as I like to call it, Oops, All Splash Pages. It is written by Jerry Duggan, pencils by Kreese Lee, whose name is 55% Ease, inks by Walden Wong, whose name is only 10% Ease, colors by Brian Valenza, and letters by Joe Caramagna. So this is an intentionally weird issue. A gimmick issue, you can call it. It's all splash pages. 18 single-page splashes and one double-page splash. Although that one has two inset panels that may be a little bit cheating. It starts with a special dedication to Walter Simonson and Sal Buscema, because this is basically a tribute to their 1987 issue, Thor number 380, which was an all-splash page fight between Thor and Jormungand, the Midgard Serpent. This issue shows us a fight between most of the giant Stark Sentinels remaining in the world, and one even more giant Mark 73 Sentinel Buster mech, piloted by Tony Stark, was inside it still wearing his Mark 72 Mysterium suit, like a Russian nesting doll of Iron Man's. I think the motivation for the all-splash-page format in both books is because they depict fights between opponents of very different sizes, which would be hard to depict in a more traditionally paneled comic. Story here, super simple. First five splash pages show Tony destroying Stark Sentinels in a variety of creative ways, including a barrage of missiles, the beam out of his chest. Is that still called a unibeam? Whatever it is, the one out of his little chest headlight there. The one that makes me think of the little robot from Buck Rogers. Remember, he had a little another AI around his... I'm old. Some people might remember that. He also kills Stark Sentinels with repulsors from his hands, and even smashing some by clapping them between the palms of his hands, Hulk style. And I'd call this the most successful part of the book. Kreese Lee continues to draw Stark-style armor and Sentinels better than just about anybody. And here the splash panels work great because it's just a montage. We know we're just getting the coolest highlights of the battle. We don't need the connecting bits. So what did you think of this first little section of this fight?
I was okay with it. It goes so fast. I think this is like a 3-minute read, this issue. And it looks cool, but I'm going to take issue with one thing you said, where how you depict large things fighting small things effectively without splash pages. I know you're not saying it's impossible, but the last issue of Transformers had this big fight with Devastator, and actually was kind of a traditional comic format and looks really cool.
I'll have to check that out. I'm not caught up on Transformers yet. I think this is one solution to that problem.
Yep. I mean, the fights are cool. The other thing I wanted to call out, and this is just a Ruben nitpick, is we don't see any Box Sentinels. So in my head canon, they're still up in Canada
This is about as far as you can get from this is Australia, as far as you can get from Canada. So I think it's a NAFTA thing. I don't think they're allowed to leave.
They can't fly as fast as Firestar. Is that what you're saying?
Nobody can fly as fast as Firestar. That's for sure. But yeah, as far as this could be a super, super quick read, or if you're the kind of reader who likes to linger over like the details of fights and zoom in on them, you could spend an awful long time looking at this really cool art if that's what you're into. So this could take you 5 minutes to read. It could take you an hour to read, depending on what you're looking for in a comic.
Yeah. And the suit ultimately gets taken down in a way that also just irritated the heck out of me.
Yeah.
Where I was like,
we'll get to it, but the idea is it's not going to be around forever.
Yeah, it's just like, how many suits have you built? And like, you're just
how much Mysterium is being used up here? What's going to happen to all that Mysterium? Totally, you know, dumping that much Mysterium into the economy is going to be total, you know, it's like if somebody discovered, you know, giant gold reserves in the middle of Rhode Island, just, you know, the whole financial system of the world would be upended.
I think I would have been just happier if, because at this point they start saying like, hey, this suit's kind of indestructible, but it uses a ton of power, right? It can't work forever. Yes. I was okay with that explanation.
It does signal that, yeah.
Yeah, I just would have been happier if it just kind of like ran out of juice, and then that's why got defeated.
So
instead, we get Fei Long punching it through the Unibeam, which apparently is a vulnerability point. It's a huge vulnerability point.
So yeah, the next part of the story begins with Fei Long's arrival on that one double page splash. He's wearing his own War Machine Sentinel armor, which is about the same size as the Stark Sentinels, so way smaller than what Tony's piloting. The fight continues, and each page still looks really cool, but here's where the limitations of that splash page format start to really become apparent to me. Because in this part, I found myself kind of flipping back and forth between pages, trying to figure out what's really going on here. For instance, on page 11, the Sentinel Buster that Tony's in is smashed to the ground by this beam, and I don't know where it comes from. Do you know what that beam is? No, and there's an Iron Man-shaped person hanging in the sky, Tiny Virgin. I don't know if that's a Sentinel because it's colored red, or was that supposed to be...
the arrival of Fei Long.
Yeah. If that's Fei Long on panel, then the beam's not coming from Fei Long. I don't know where this is coming from. And then later on, Tony exits the Sentinel Buster, puts it on autopilot, and now he's flying around being even smaller than the regular Stark Sentinels, the regular human-sized Tony. And then we got a panel where Fei Long's in the grasp of the Sentinel Buster, about to be pounded into a fine mist. But then on the next page, Fei Long, like you say, is instead punching the Sentinel Buster right through the chest at some kind of a weak point. And how did we get from point A to point B? How did he escape what seemed to be certain doom here? We don't have the panels to explain it. We only get one panel per page because that's the gimmick.
Yeah. So he got shot when he's outside of the suit.
Yeah, Tony
gets
shot.
And then he flies back into the suit for some reason.
Right.
And then he lets go of Fei Long so that Fei Long can then punch him. It just doesn't exactly make sense.
Doesn't really make sense. And then we cut to inside where Tony's connected to all these wires again, and his helmet's off for some reason. Why is his helmet off? His helmet's off because later on he needs to get a concussion for the story to happen.
Yeah.
And also,
like,
we get
in
to
the middle
see
of a combat scene, he takes it off for zero reason. That's where I was just kind of like, come on, Duggan.
Yeah. And maybe if we had more panels to explain it, they would have been, he gets knocked aside. And who knows? It could have been some excuse, but here it just kind of comes and goes. So at the end of the issue, results for Tony are mixed at best. Yes, he's destroyed a whole passel of Stark Sentinels. Neat to see them littering the ground like broken toys. That's a cool looking last panel here. But the Sentinel Buster is out of power, badly damaged, and inside, Tony himself was hit by debris without a helmet on and now has a concussion. The War Machine armor is smoking too, so for all we know, they're all out of commission. But the narration boxes tell us that there are, quote, more bogeys inbound to Australia.
It's the Box Sentinels.
Maybe those are the Box Sentinels. They're a little slow, but they get there. Maybe, are there more Stark Sentinels, more regular Sentinels? Are there Box Sentinels? Are the bogeys? They're probably not like giant Humphrey Bogarts, although that would be fun too.
Nobody's going to remember the Box Sentinels except for me. I'm going to remember for until the day I die.
I don't think there's going to be like a McFarlane action figure of the Box Sentinels, but if there is, I'm buying you one. So if they exist, somebody get at me and I will get Ruben his McFarlane Box Sentinel. Okay, one thing I want to bring up before we give our scores. Ruben, when you picture a Stark Sentinel, how tall do you think it is?
Oh, God. Yeah, we had a lot of conversations about this. It's bigger than 30 feet.
Yeah. So yeah, we talked about this on the Slack, and hey, listeners out there, if you're not on the Slack,
right?
Get on this. I did the math. So
yeah.
In an early narration box in this issue, Tony Stark puts an actual number on the height, and he says they're 30 feet tall. And that just seems low to me, right? We've seen these robots pick up a human or a human-sized mutant, like carry him around King Kong style. So I did the math, and if a 30-foot tall sentinel has the same proportions as a perfectly proportioned human, i.e. me, the width of its hand, including thumb, would be just about 2 feet, which is way, way smaller than what we've seen pick up people. I mean, even if you want to say that sentinel hands are proportionally a bit larger than human ones, it still doesn't quite work.
The math doesn't work.
Doesn't lower my score or anything. I'm fine with the sentinels being however large they need to be for a scene to look cool. Right? Like, people talk about this really crazy in a lot of the Godzilla and King Kong movies, where the scale of the monster just varies wildly from scene to scene, but I'm fine with it. It's part of the whole deal. I thought it was just curious that Duggan would put a number on it. I would just avoid the whole number thing if it was me. Okay, so to wrap up, this issue was a pretty fun fight. The gimmick worked well enough. I don't need to see this gimmick used again for another 20 years, but you know, once every 25, 30 years or so, it's a cool thing to do. They have the right artist for this kind of gimmick. Kreese Lee draws super cool techno armor sentinel stuff. And yeah, if that's what you love in comics, you want to see cool depictions of armor and tech, this is an issue you got to have. Story-wise, not a whole lot going on. We got rid of a bunch of sentinels. We're going to get rid of these brand new armors and this new war machine armor. But yeah, it's nothing too earth-shattering there. It's certainly the best Jerry Duggan issue of the month, but that's not a very high bar. But a perfectly fine issue, totally okay. It does what it needs to do. 7 out of 10.
Yeah, that's exactly where I'm at. I had issues with it. The fight and the helmet just really irked me, this calling out the number. But the fight was, in general, a cool concept.
The helmet is the real plot hole that is bothersome. That maybe, yeah, somebody should have pointed out, hey, come up with a reason for why his helmet's not there.
A better reason, yeah.
Something.
It gets knocked off or something, but yeah, we didn't see any of that. So, I don't know. But the fight was cool. It advances the story. We're kind of getting to the conclusion of the Phelan-Tony conflict, which I'm ready for that to be over. I feel bad for the environment of Australia. Because even though there's no humans there, there must have been something there, but now it's just a scrap heap. But
yeah, a bunch of snakes and giant spiders have their habitat ruined. I'm pretty sure that's the only thing that lives in the middle of Australia.
Yeah. Well, in 10 years, somebody could write a story about how they repurposed all this scrap metal into something terrible.
It could be. I mean, it's almost like what happened to Wakanda, right? This giant meteorite of vibranium landed there, and now this giant sort of meteorite of mysterium crashes into Australia. So it'd be a whole civilization based on it. Okay, moving on from that issue to our final issue of the day, and this is Resurrection of Magneto, number 3 of 4, Falls the Shadow, which is a line from a T.S. Eliot poem. It's written by Al Ewing, art by Luciano Vecchio, colors by David Curiel and Jesus Abertov, letters by Joe Sabino, and design by our two favorites, Tom Muller and Jay Bowen. So this is an issue where I could have written 12 pages of notes, or I could have written like half a page of notes, depending on how much I wanted to get into it. And looking at my document, I've got about half a page of notes to talk about here.
Yeah, that's ultimately how I approached it. I read it. It felt like I was trying to do something big, and then it pulled back from those ideas, and it ends up being pretty easy to explain. But it does look great, and yeah, I guess that's that. It looks great, and it accomplishes the title of the series, right? Magneto's Resurrected.
It's the kind of book that a lot of people are really loving. It gets, you know, deep into the characterization and the history of these two favorite characters, but it's just like aggressively not for me. It does a thing that I didn't need to do, and it does it at a great length. So just to go through the actual actions of the plot here. At the end of issue number 2, Magneto turned his magic key and got himself and Storm dumped into a room with someone who looked like the Shadow King. And after reading this whole issue, I can confidently state that I still don't really know if that was the Shadow King. The concept seems to be that this is a primal evil entity that has been embodied in all sorts of villains over the years, including the Shadow King and Annihilation, but also, Ruben, stop me if you're familiar with any of these, we have Bête Noire, This is the one that looks like Space Ghost on Fire. He comes from a 2001 Gambit and Bishop miniseries. Gambit and Bishop, that's an odd couple. I wonder what that was about. I mean, it was about Bette Noire. The next version is the Adversary. This is the one that looks like a blue-skinned Native American, which kind of problematic, but it was the 80s. He's an uncanny X-Men villain from 1987. Now we have the First Fallen. He looks like an Egyptian version of Angel. He appeared in two Chris Claremont issues of Uncanny in 2006. He's described as a force in opposition to the Phoenix, in that the Phoenix is all about change, and the First Fallen is all about stagnation, not changing. And finally, we have a Batman-looking figure with a jagged green outline. This is, and I couldn't believe it when I found this name, the Goblin Force. Seems like a kind of a combination of Phoenix and Galactus. He comes from a 1998 Howard Mackey series called Mutant X. The Goblin Force, this is what he did in that series. The Goblin Force possessed the comatose body of the Beyonder, and then he teamed up with Dracula. The 90s were a wacky time, guys. Mutant X apparently had a 32-issue run. Not a series I'm familiar with. Maybe that'll be our next fill in the gaps between the eras read. We'll read Mutant X. Okay, moving on. Storm and Magneto decide that while they must accept that evil forces do exist, including within themselves, to be heroes, they must oppose those evil forces, including those within themselves. So that one sentence I just read, that's about a dozen pages of this book. Super symbolic dialogue that my brain just did not want to read. My eyes were just bouncing off of these word bubbles. At the end of the fight with the Shadow King, if it is the Shadow King, Storm nearly dies, but Magneto harnesses her lightning somehow, magnets, I guess, to shock her back to life in the world of the dead, at the same time that, back in the Blue Marvel's Kaddish base, Taya is shocking Storm's body back to life in the real world. So Storm is alive again, and on the last page, a young, buff, very naked Magneto steps back into the world of the living, which would be a huge surprise to anyone who hadn't read the title of the series. So yeah, some people are going to love this. They're going to tell me I'm missing all these nuances and how these characters are great, and now we know the true Magneto and the true Storm. Okay, I just don't care. And for me, this four-issue series could have been a perfectly serviceable one-shot. Maybe extended one-shot, 30 pages, fine. But four issues of this navel-gazing is just three issues too many for me. And maybe that's my fault, maybe that's my failing for not getting it, but I don't get it. So I'm going to not even characterize what kind of 5 out of 10, but this is the fivest 5 out of 10 that has ever 5 out of 10.
I can't give it a 5. I think it was the art's too good for that. But I gotta compare it to like the last one I reviewed, right? So I'll give it a 7. But
7, okay.
It's an extremely disinterested 7, which is it's hard to explain. Like,
is it like an objective 7 versus a subjective? Please don't make me read anymore.
Yeah, I will never read this issue again. And I share your perspective of like I didn't need to know these characters at this level. Mm-hmm. And I felt like there's a lot of stuff going on here, right? With, you know, their personality and what motivates them and how they think about each other in the world. And I just, I didn't care for any of it. Even the dialogue, like page to page dialogue, it's like decent dialogue, but what it's talking about and what it's addressing just bored me.
Yeah. Again, it reminds me of those 1980s and 1990s perfume commercials, like Egoist, and it was all this dream logic and surrealist imagery, and it wasn't supposed to make sense. It was just supposed to sell perfume. And I think this is supposed to make sense, but I just don't get it. I did happen to look up the reviews for this in the Comic Book Roundup. There's only 3 reviews. Those scores are, from top to bottom, 9.7, then an 8.8, and then a 3.0. So I think that sums up the reaction to this book. You're either going to love it. If it's for you, you're going to love it. If it's not for you, you don't need to read it.
I felt like there was a big story of this idea of like there's an evil behind the evil, but it wasn't even really revealed, right?
Yeah,
like
it's not
cool.
Like this is going to be a big thing going forward, right? This is just something that Al Ewing likes to do. Like he likes to talk about the one below all in the Hulk. He likes to gesture towards these, here's what's behind it all, and in a way that, you know, makes me stop reading Immortal Hulk and makes me not want to read any more of this Resurrection of Magneto. But
well, I look at those characters. It's like 6 characters, right? six villains, and you're kind of like, I'm invested in the Annihilation Mask as a villain, but I am completely aware of the fact that it's not really a villain that people care for and that's going to be around in 10 years. So if you were to tell me, like, hey, there's a new villain, and it's like, you know, the depth of these six characters, I don't think anyone really care, except for maybe Shadow King, right? Like, people don't want.
Yeah. Those are the character. Two that really matter. And Ewing does a little bit of a thing with that stagnation one, because he wants to make a point of stagnation versus change. But yeah, if this was setting up something going forward, it could be cool, but we know it's not.
But it's just not. It's just sort of like
this one thing.
Yeah, this metaphysical nonsense. You're in the afterlife, and you had to come to terms with who you are, and are you a hero or a villain, and you both decide you're heroes and friends, and now we're back to life. Yay.
Yep. And either you buy into that and think it's cool, or you say, yeah, I've seen this 1,000 times and it's not as deep as you think it is. Okay. We've talked this one to death more than it needs to be, but
let me recant.
Take it one more time. Go for it.
Yeah. I'm just going to go to a 5.5. I shouldn't be scoring something that is not enjoyable. 7. So let me say 5.5. I think the art is good. That's sort of why I think a 5 is not fair, but whatever the story was being told, it feels like a waste of money.
Art is very cool. The artist again is Vecchio. What's his name again? It is blah, blah, blah. All credit to Luciano Vecchio with the colors. Very cool looking colors. A lot of that, you know, really stand out because of the black backgrounds. Colors by David Curiel and Jesus Abertov. They get a ton of credit for this issue. It looks amazing. Okay, that was this week's book. So one we really loved, one we thought was perfectly fine, and the third one didn't so much care for. Next week, let's hope we love them all. Next week, we're going to talk about three books. X-Force number 50, which is the final Krakoa era issue of that, you know, long-running title. We have Rotpox number 3, more Kieran Gillen, hooray. This is when Professor X should be meeting to have that talk with young Moira. And we have Wolverine number 46, with Logan being mind-controlled by Sabretooth and Kid Omega on Krakoa. So that should be fun. There are three more books of interest next week that we're probably not going to talk about, but you should know about them. It's Cable number 3, continuing that mini-series that's not so much connected with this ongoing story.
I'll cover it.
Number 6 does come out next week. So if you're reading along that Hickman Gods book, you can pick that up. And again, Ruben, you and I will talk about these books sometime, a little brief chat.
Probably during the next break, week. Is my guess.
That'll be a good time to do it. And there's also a book called X-Men 97 number 1.
Which seriously?
Seriously, it's a four-part miniseries written by Steve Fox.
Get in on that.
It does say it's an official prelude to the hotly anticipated Disney Plus show.
Oh my gosh.
That's so hilarious. Maybe this fills in whatever gap there is between those two. So I'm going to take a look at it, and Ruben, you can probably take a look at it and tell us what you think of if it's worth looking at.
You should read it before you watch the episode, right?
I guess it'll, so. It'll well, first, I should watch all 7,000 episodes of the original series, then read this book.
I know people are making fun of me for kind of liking Steve Fox, but I feel bad for him because, like, there's really nothing that you need to know to, like, watch that first episode. Like, I had zero confusion. So
he's done some books like this recently. He did the House of Roman numerals, whatever it was, to make it look like the cartoon version of House of X. So he's been writing these characters in this milieu for a while. So he's the right writer to do this, but could be fun. It could be just a throwaway cashing.
Yeah, it just sounds annoying. Because like I said, there's like not a lot confusing about. I mean, maybe if I was such a deep aficionado of the animated series, I would have been like, this doesn't work, right? Maybe
yeah, we're not going to continuity stuff, kid the animated universe. I don't know if we have the expertise for that. Not that we have the expertise for anything, but definitely not for that. Okay, so wrapping this thing up, Ruben, any advice for what our listeners can do between now and next week?
Yeah, give me some more X-Men comics, and I'll say thank you, Kieran Gillen, for making me feel that way this week, because last week I was really not feeling it.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Kieran Gillen, for making Ruben not want to quit the podcast. Appreciate it. Bye, everybody.